And he said, well, apparently the Queen listens. You're on the radio in London. You're playing pop music. There is no better life. A lot of people say it's commercial radio, it's all done for you. No, it's not.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Richard Allanson.
Comfortable, middle class, ambitious parents. I didn't see much of my dad in the first few years because he was in construction. And so apparently I was born in Lichfield in Staffordshire. But when we were two, we moved to Hall Green in Birmingham. And I stayed there for about, I think, 18 months. And my first memory was him leaning over around about 6 o'clock on a Monday morning, could kiss me goodbye. And I'd nip into his space in the bed next to my mum. And he would drive up to Middlesbrough and stay there all week because he was building something. He used to sell iron and steel reinforcement for concrete and anything that supplied the building industry. I didn't see him for like 5 days, so I was with my mum for a lot of the time. And then he'd come back at the weekends and I'd like to do things like wash the car and just play with my dad. And we moved around a lot, so we ended up living in just outside Middlesbrough in Marton. And then we moved to Edinburgh, and my mother was Scots, so we got some family there. And then we came back via Sheffield, back to Birmingham, and moved around Birmingham and Shirley and Solihull. My first school was Captain Cook's School on the Stokesley Road in Marton. Hated it. Hated school. Couldn't understand anything about school. Hated everybody else. Didn't have many friends. It was odd. But I did like listening to the radio, because there was David Jacobs and Daphne Oxenford. This is the dark ages now, okay.
Good afternoon. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
And also, there was a crack in the case. It was a Bakelite cut. I think it was a Bush. And it was sitting in the kitchen on the side next to the boiler, which was where the only power point was. And it was a valve radio. You'd turn it on, and because there was a crack in the back next to the grill, I could see the valves getting red hot. And when the valves got red hot, I knew that the voices started to come out and the music started to come out. And so I thought, there is somebody actually waking up. I was two. So that there's somebody waking up, and when the thing inside goes red, then I can hear them. And it was just a different world. And then I was bought, for my fifth birthday, I think, a little transistor. And I did listen to Man United beating Benfica in Europe on medium wave. And I did get up an hour early to listen to Radio 1 and Radio 2 start in 1967, Saturday morning.
Good morning. This is Paul Hollingdale on this opening day of Radio 1 and Radio 2, welcoming you to Breakfast Special, which will be broadcast on the usual light programme wavelengths up to 7 o'clock. But at 7, well, Breakfast Special continues on Radio 2 on 1500 metres and VHF. And, of course, Radio 1 on 247 will be breaking away for the first time with the Tony Blackburn Show.
When I was 13, myself and two friends started a mobile disco. We had a lot of love of turntables and vinyl and things with switches on. Stuck it up in the church hall, and we got paid £1.50 to do a dance one Saturday afternoon for some kids. And we thought, oh, and it went quite well. And they asked us to go back again next week. So anyway, by the time we were 18, there was just two of us. I did O-level woodwork. One of my projects was making reflex-loaded speaker cabinets and also the desk. So we had the only speakers in Birmingham which had dovetail joints and rebated backs and things, and the badges were cut in, and I liked woodwork. And we were doing quite well. We could charge 25 quid if we did 8 till midnight, but 9 till 1 we charged 45. So that was quite handy, and we did lots and lots of 9 till 1 gigs, which sort of got in the way of the A-levels a bit, so I dropped a couple of points in my A-levels. And I thought, well, I've got to go to university, because everybody says I've got to go to university. I don't know why. So I ended up going to Lancaster to do economics, which was sort of the wrong course, and it was sort of the wrong university because that wasn't on my plan. But the studios of the campus radio station were in my college. So one night I popped in there and I said, hello. And they said, yeah, come back. We're looking for new DJs. So two nights later, I went back in and said, hello. And they said, the new DJ hasn't turned up. And they said, do you want to go on? And I went, you're kidding me. He said, yeah, be easy. Here's a song. And it was real Heath Robinson string and chewing gum, this was. Completely unsuitable turntables and an old mixer. It was in a wooden cabinet. But it sort of worked. And so I was, what was the first song? I was coming out of Do Anything You Want to Do. And I was going into I Shot the Sheriff. So all I had to say was, hello, I'm the new DJ. Play a jingle and let go of the slip mat. And off we went. So I did an hour of that, and they said, do you want to do this again tomorrow? I had three very happy years playing around on university radio. It was fun. I'd record every show and chop out the bits I liked, and I sent it off to about 10 stations on cassette. Heard nothing. So by that time, I'd got a job at Lucas's, which was going to start after I graduated. And I thought, well, I didn't really want this job. And there's only one job, and I got it. And I was going to get paid £7,500 a year, marketing fuel injection systems. Great. So I graduated, and then Neil Pringle was at the year below me at Lancaster, and he went on to, I think he's still on, he's doing a breakfast show somewhere on the BBC, and his identical twin brother, and I've known them for hundreds of years, and I still get their names wrong, he was at Trent Polly, I think, at the time. But they both lived in, I think it was St. Albans, and they both loved Capital, and they would bring air checks up. So Neil went on to do broadcasting. Keith went on to run Heart and then run Capital. And they're both radio legends in my mind. But they would bring tapes, air checks of Capital up to Lancaster. He said, Dave Cash is leaving Capital because he was going to go to Bristol to start GWR. He said, send him a tape. I said, don't be silly, I'm going to drive a Capri and market fuel injection systems. The world is my whatever. No, send them one. And I had one copy of it left. My finals had finished. I'd got my results. We were all just out getting drunk and having a good time. 3 days later, Tim Blackmore is on the phone. He was head of music at Capital at the time. So 3 days later, I'm in their office. I'm in Tim's office. He brings in Aidan Day, who was the program controller. They said, look, we've never hired anybody from university before. All that, Michael Aspel was on in the morning. Mike Smith had just taken over breakfast show from Graham Dean. Everybody else had come from the biscuit factory. Super Sound, UBM. You don't know anything about university radio. They said, how about doing some overnights? And in my mind, I wanted to make tea. Because I thought, if I've got my foot in the door, I'll be okay.
Right, the flatshare line is open right now until 5:30. We're looking for as many flat vacancies as possible, so if you'd like to use our free service, the number's 484-5255.
Capital at the time was like, it was big. There was community radio, there was a news service, they ran an orchestra, there was promotions and marketing and producers doing content. It was like a scaled-down Radio 2 stroke 4 thing, and it was fascinating. So I had a quick tour. They said, well, we'll think about it. Went, yeah, great, okay. Went back to home, Solihull. My parents weren't too keen on this at the time. And then Tim phones up and says, look, forget about the overnights. You want to do the chart show on a Sunday afternoon?
Yes.
That was it. I do remember, because Princess Alexandra was giving it. She was the Chancellor of Lancaster, giving us our degrees, and she stopped me and said, what are you going to be doing? I said, broadcasting on Capital Radio. She said, oh, lovely, we listened to that. And so 5 weeks later, I think it was August the 9th, Sunday, August the 9th, 1980, I did the UK Top 30.
The Capital Countdown.
It was recorded because they were rebuilding some studios, and I'm going to name him. The producer was a guy called Jeremy Lloyd, who went on to run Carlton. It was not a happy experience because I was being driven, because the only recording studio that was available was that one. And the first time the guy started the number 30 song too soon, so I crashed the vocals. So sorry, we'll do that again. So we did it again. And the producer didn't edit out the first take. So I'm sitting at home with my mates and we hear this go out and I thought, that's wrong. And then 20 seconds later, it stopped and the whole show started again. Which, of course, was embarrassing in itself. But then 2 hours later, when it got to the countdown at number one, we had to go into IRN News on the hour. We had to chase the number one and it was Upside Down, Diana Ross. We only played half the number one.
I said, upside down, you're turning me, you're giving love instinctively.
I went in the next morning, and Mike Smith said, you poor bugger. And Roger Scott came in and said, how was that then? And Fluff came in, bless Fluff, Fluff came in, and he's the originator of the chart show format, isn't he? He wrote the book, and he came in and said, listen, hardly anybody heard that, but even if they did, forget it, there'll be another one along next week. And he, in fact, those two guys gave me the best bits of advice ever. Roger Scott said, keep your head down. And Fluff said, so what are you doing? I said, well, I'm here for 5 weeks. Do you want to stay here? I said, love to stay here. He said, right, work fucking hard. That's what you have to do. Work, work, work. And he was right. At the time, he'd come from Radio 1.
It would take at least 24 hours of solid transmission to gather our last 5 years together and even hope to represent them in our final 3 hours. And today's music is chosen by you, the Saturday music lover, and the Giants on album.
He was doing the Alan Freeman rock show, and it was every night. So he was in like 10 o'clock in the morning, 60 cigarettes, big ashtray, load of records, pens, two stopwatches, and he would sit at the bar in the edge of the playpen where there were turntables, amplifiers and headphones where you could preview records and stuff. And he would sit there and he would time the whole of his 2-hour rock show every night. It would take him about 4 hours to do it. And he would write down which bits of classical jingle he was going to play and what he was going to say. Because he never jocked an intro. It was all about the setup. And to watch him work, it was just laborious. And I just thought, God, that's Alan Freeman. He's a legend, and he does that.
24 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock on Capital Radio now, and it's time to open the Flatshare line. We're about 3 minutes late, actually, but never mind. The number is 48452.
Life at Capital was interesting because I had no idea about the scale of the production. I'd never seen a proper playlist before and a playlist rotation system. I'd never operated a desk that was that big. I'd never sat next to Michael Aspel and Kenny Everett and Richard Attenborough and Roger Scott. The building was phenomenal because so many people said, are the studios really at the top of Euston Tower? We only had half the ground floor and that sort of plinth bit, the first floor. The studios were quite disappointing because you couldn't see out. And Euston Road is a really busy part of London. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to be at least a couple of floors up, but actually looking out and seeing all that buzz? And when you have your photo in the window and you're 10 feet tall with your name under it and people are walking past and you're 21 and you're just out of university and you just go, what? It's a bit odd. I'm sure I went entirely odd for a while. That was big time for me. That was huge. For about 6 months, they sold me the idea that it would be a really good idea to do a Friday night show from midnight till 6 in the morning. And I said, yeah, okay. And that was knackering. And then there was early breakfast, which was 4 until 7 in the morning. And then Mike Smith would take over. And I still believe people actually listen to the radio first thing in the morning and last thing at night. All the time. It's not just on in the background at those times of day. An intimate part in their lives. You're probably in the bathroom or the bedroom. And it's a very personal time. So if you get things right, you get a fantastic response. But God, if you get things wrong, or if you misjudge something, they do let you know. There was one woman. It's quite sad. I remember having a drink in the pub. Most of the proper business at Capital went on in the pub. So about 9 o'clock, I went out to the pub with Tim. We had a couple of beers. And he said, I said, look, who's listening? Who am I talking to? And he said, well, apparently the Queen listens. And you're 21 and you're straight out of school, effectively. And also, there'll be a 16-year-old single mother with one or two kids in sheltered housing in Tower Hamlets. And you've got to convince her, you know, a little bit about life as well, because I suspect she knows a hell of a lot more about it than you do. So if you can keep those two profiles engaged, then you might be doing something right. But I remember one woman sent me a ring. And then the helpline people, the social side, got involved. And I said, well, why don't I just say, look, it probably looks better on you. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. But I'm sending it back because it probably looked better on you. And then I think she took the hint. There are lots of people who are lonely, radio is a huge comfort. And I think we all laughed a bit to start with, but then thinking about it, we said, well, you know, this is quite sad. A lot of people, the only thing they have and the only friendly voices they will hear will be on radio. TV doesn't work like that. TV's great, some fantastic images, but they're all in front of you. You don't need to really engage to watch TV. It's there. You just take it all in.
Help us on the chat on Capital Radio.
Now, Fluff has been dragged off to be replaced by Richard Allen over this final couple of hours. Your first year of this, isn't it, Richard?
Absolutely, Roger. My first time with you as well.
Oh, yes, this is true. Oh, we are having some nice matches this afternoon. So, we have sufficient funds
we
to
had
play,
a thing on the Late Show on Capital, because after earlies, I went to the other end of the scale and did 10 till midnight. And we had the last half hour was something we call Pillow Talk, because we got a lot of letters in from people who were wanted dedications to loved ones. And you play what we rather quaintly referred to in the 80s as love songs, and read out people's dedications. And after a while, it was pretty obvious that lots of people wanted dedications for people who they weren't with because they were with someone else. And on more than one occasion, there were guys waiting outside the tower after midnight because they'd heard that someone in their lives was having an affair with someone else, and I was the catalyst, and they wanted a conversation. Daytime. The main thing about that was I had to be in it in the afternoon. Now, being on Capital at the time, people used to phone up and say, do you want to go and do things? So at the time, I was doing a world service show with lovely Dave Tate, who'd moved from Radio 1. That was called Multitrack, and that was a live. It was a long one. It was 30 minutes. And we were playing new music. And we had on attachment a young guy called Jeff Smith, who loved music and brought new music in every week. He then went on to run Radio 1 and Capital, and then, at the time of this recording, is still head of music at Radio 2 and 6 Music. Lovely guy. Always brought in loads of new music. So I would do that, and then I'd go to work at Capital. But in the afternoons, from 2 till half 4, when the clocks changed, I couldn't do the world service thing, because in Greenwich Mean Time it meant that the rehearsal time encroached on the Capital show, so I had to say goodbye to that. In the meantime as well, I'd been doing a new music show for the British Forces Broadcasting Service, and their studios were ideally placed at the other end of Marylebone Road in Paddington. And then I took over from Tommy Vance on the daily Your Link With Home show. So I'd do that in the morning, go to Capital in the afternoon. Then VH1 started, and so I would do Capital in the morning, and then I would do VH1, and then BFBS, and that lasted for about 3 years, and I think I went mad again. But the daytimes were crazy, because the response was bigger, the office was full. I'm pretty sure less people heard the show. I mean, less of the bosses heard the show. I've always been convinced that if you're on sometime between 9 and 5, no one actually hears it because they're all in meetings doing their stuff. If you're first thing in the morning or last thing at night, everybody hears it and you get your whole ethos pulled apart the next day. Why did you do that? Was that the right thing to say? And we only have 3 rules. If you've got nothing to say, say nothing. Number 2, cut the crap. Number 3, get on with it. So I thought, well, you really want me to be fairly redundant, don't you? It's shut up and play a record. And they said, well, with that in mind, yeah. Because it's far too easy. I've been doing this a long time. It's far too easy to get indulgent and throttle back a bit. Or knock it into neutral and just be a bit more self-indulgent. It's much better to say, again, you know, you're against the clock. Keep it going. I remember when Richard Park came and joined us. And he joined as head of music, first of all. Tarrant was on Breakfast, and I think that was his pet project to start with. It was to get that up in the big numbers.
Chris Tarrant on Capital Radio.
Rubbish! Now, this may or may not be a very good idea. We've got a compact disc here. We had 4 engineers and half the building trying to get it to work. Hang on, if I do what? Leave that here.
Capital got quite complacent a couple of years before. We didn't have a head of music, really, for about a year. There wasn't a great deal of direction from programming. a lot of us got quite complacent. I think the whole station got complacent. And Richard came in and said, no, we have to be much more aggressive and much more confident in our appreciation of pop music. And he was the first guy that actually said, it's great to be on the, you know, you're 25, you're on the radio in London, you're playing pop music. Fantastic. There is no better life. So tell people about it. And you think, oh yeah, you might be right. I listen to kids on the radio now, and they sound like they could not be happier. They sound like they're pigs in slurry. And there's so much talent now. I grew up in an age where we weren't, there wasn't media studies. There wasn't anything like, this is how you get good on the radio. This is how you, you know, persevere with a career in broadcasting. But at the time, there was very little coaching, apart from the first document I was given when I signed my contract at Capital was 4 pages of A4, defining the things that had been proved to be libelous and slanderous. But as far as coaching was concerned, no, occasionally Richard would say, yeah, that thing, don't do that. Okay. I think I got on with him pretty well because he had a focus. He had a definite idea of what a number one hit radio station in London should sound like. And after a couple of years in London, and he got London, he came in once and he said, he'd been out to lunch. He'd been out to, it was an awards lunch. And they came back in about 3:30. They, Richard Park and Pete Waterman. I reckon Pete had collared Richard at this thing. And he brought in a cartridge on which was the new Kylie single. It was just after 3:00. And we did this really radical thing at the time of playing three songs out of 3:00 with me not saying anything. And I said, look, Steve Wright's on Radio 1. He's killing it on Radio 1. You've told me to overtake Steve Wright in London. And Kenny Everett's on Capital Gold. Okay, so I'm thinking this is a hiding to nothing. We'd overtaken Steve Wright within 18 months by playing lots and lots of records and giving away lots of tickets. And that was basically it. He came in with Pete Waterman. He said, this is the new Kylie single. They mastered it this morning. It's on a cartridge. And I said, have you heard it? And Pete said, it's a number one. And it was Hand on My Heart. And it starts off, put your hand on your heart. And yeah. So I put the cart in and it's a 5-minute cart. Now, it takes about 3 minutes to re-cue. So I said, well, I can play it now or I can hear it. And he said, just play it. So what am I going to say? What's it called? He said, Capital, jingle, something really special. This is brand new. No one's ever heard this before. The brand new song from Kylie, and hit the button. Put your hand on your heart and tell me. And it was glorious. And so they went away happy. But I just remember that time. Because then about 45 minutes later, I said, can I play it again? He said, yeah, go on then. It was that sort of instantaneous response we could get. And it was something he sort of engendered. He had a very, very definite idea of where Capital should be. I found that really inspirational because if you played along with it, he'd back you up. If you didn't, then, you know, you were made to feel in no uncertain terms that you weren't performing.
George Michael, spin the wheel. Falling down outside. Have a brilliant Wednesday. It should get sunny later, and we rise at 5 tomorrow. 2 to 7. CT next.
I'd been at Capital 17 years, and I was going, well, I want to do something else. Can I sustain this until I'm 40? And I thought, well, there's no point in going somewhere smaller. And Radio 2 needs a bit of a kick. This was 1997. And then Tim Blackmore again comes along on the phone. I'd done a few programs with Unique, and they were producing the Jamesons on Radio 2. And Derek and Ellen were leaving. Unique had kept the contract, and they were going to carry on doing it. So he said, we'll have to make a pilot. Make a pilot? Oh, I made a pilot once before for the World Service show with Dave Tate, because Dave was had to convince, I think it was his boss, that I could present pop music to an audience whose second or third language was English. So would my diction be okay? And apparently it was all right. So then I had to go and make a pilot to convince Jim Moore at Radio 2 that I was going to be okay for this. And then I found out a couple of big nationally known names that also had to make pilots. And then I found out that Jim took it around about four or five local clinics, and there were review panels and people giving their judgment on it. And, Christ. Anyway, they said, do you want to do the Late Show on Radio 2? Of course I do. Perfect. And it was great to work with Tim again, because he has a sort of a vision that is broader than just the medium. And I don't know where he gets it from. We got a gold Sony within 9 months. That's the one I'm proudest of, because that was something that... Nothing's ever perfect, but that was about as close as it got to the programme that I sort of wanted to do.
The old Shy Lights ploy then, on a Tuesday night. It probably feels like Monday because that old bank holiday thing, doesn't it? Yeah. My name's Richard Allenson, it's Late Night Radio 2. And we've just been doing nothing since about 7 o'clock listening to Goon's Night on Radio 2. It's just been absolutely brilliant.
Jim Moyer said he wanted to refresh the evenings, first of all. And he didn't want to play around with daytime. He didn't want to make one change, more than one change at once. His attitude was very much television. Put a star name on the front and people will come. And I wasn't a star name. And I'm quite glad of that, because I had an agent once who said, well, what do you want to do in your life? Do you want to take gold for 5 years, or do you want to take silver for the rest of your life? And I thought, that's quite an interesting way of looking at it. So he said, we'll refresh that part of the evening. I didn't think he had a bigger plan. I just thought this was... Derek and Ellen had had a good run. Let's do something else.
Ellen, no H, Jameson. Hello, everyone.
And I'm Derek. Yes, the Jameson. Something new and different in radio. Husband and wife presenting a leisurely bedtime series, Mondays to Thursdays.
So then Radio 2 was, if you remember, it was Sarah Kennedy, Terry Wogan, Jimmy Young, Debbie Thrower, Ed Stewart, John Dunn, and then that bloke with the organ would entertain at some stage. And so, yeah, this was slightly different. I think I'm putting Wogan's audience to bed. So what are they like? And the only demographic we really got was about 60% of Radio 2's audience was over 60. And so you're inheriting a program that was very much into the good old days and remembering the past. I seem to remember lots of World War II references. But I'd come from Capital, which was, I was feeling quite old at Capital by that stage. It was great, it was fun, and I think they liked it. It was the tip that made Radio 2 then go, okay, that seems to work. Let's bring Jonathan Ross in. Let's bring Steve Wright in. Steve Wright was already doing Saturday mornings, and they put him on in the afternoon. And then that was that taken care of for a while. Now what are we going to do? Evolution rather than revolution, I think.
Hey, it's getting late. And the reason I say it's getting late, because the children are in bed. Who are the sexiest over 60s? Maybe they should have voted. The top five women, I don't know whether you saw this in the papers today, in reverse order, Raquel Welch is the sexiest over 60.
Whenever Gary five, Rhodes and Nigella and chefs would come in and bring food, the Radio 2 studio at that time in the old broadcasting house shared continuity with Radio 3 and Radio 4. Radio 3 are Gannett's. If Gary Rhodes would bring in bread and butter pudding, I'd have a little bit of it, and he'd take it back to the control room for the engineers. Radio 3 would get the whiff of this, come down the corridor, nick it all. Bastards. We had so many great live performances. I wasn't a huge fan of that, because I thought, they don't sound anything like the records. It's late at night. Andrew Neil had always been out to a very long dinner before he came in, as did Richard Whiteley. Richard Whiteley would bring in the most attractive women, much younger than him. That was always baffling to me. I don't know how he did that. For the first time in my career, it was almost like anything you asked for was there. I wasn't a great fan of doing lots of live music at that time of night, because I thought it might be a bit jarry. Now it's on everywhere. The BBC has massive resources, and if you use them wisely and creatively, you can do something really special. And it was just that sort of attitude that, why don't we phone them up and ask if they want to come in? And lots of people did. And the guest list was phenomenal. Radio 2 were quite brave then, because that was basically, they called it a daytime show. It was a strip show, 5 days a week, but it was four. But it was then if you were an independent production company in 1997, you were doing the occasional special. You weren't doing strips. Unique had that since about 94, I think, with the Jameson show. And they'd had it with Something Understood on Radio 4. So I think it showed a lot of faith on Radio 2's part to give those programmes to an independent. And also, I think we were sort of more at arm's length. So we could do pretty much what we wanted, but we had to clear some of it. That's how it felt. So I could have an idea and not put it on that night, but we had to wait maybe another night. They would spend money on their presenters. The Radio 2 Christmas dinner party was always a very grand affair. I got taken out to lunch quite a lot just to discuss things and talk to people and meet people that I'd never met. If I said something nice about a big band special or something good about an Oscar Peterson, I remember saying something brilliant. I was a huge fan of Oscar Peterson. I saw him play once when I was about 11 and I said, well, that's it, I'm giving up piano lessons. Can't do this. Hopeless. Somebody made a programme on Oscar Peterson that came into The Late Show, because we followed a different show every night. And the Oscar Peterson programme finished, and I was just laughing, because I thought, no one can play a piano like that. It's phenomenal. And the producer phoned up and said, thanks for that. And I tell Leslie Douglas this, and so then we go out to lunch. She arranges a lunch and says, it will be good to meet, and there was a great feeling of, if you were part of the family, it was a good place to be. Of all the presentations I've sat through at the BBC, and there'll be quite a few, they like numbers when they're going up. When the numbers are going down, they don't talk about them, they talk about other things. But they talked about programmes and what they wanted to create and what they wanted to do. I've always thought, you never ask an audience what they want. You go to a restaurant, the chef comes out with a menu, this is what I'm cooking, choose. If you go to a radio station, don't ask the audience what they want to do. Ask them what they do. Ask them who they are and where they are and what they're doing. But don't ask them what they want, because a lot of the time they don't seem to know. But it's our job to deliver that, I think. I think if you can listen to the listener, you'll know more about them than asking them lots of questions. Magnum Opus was a thing that we were far, far too late in doing. I bumped into Steve Levine at a thing called Raw 94. That Capital was doing. It sounded like a mag you'd find on the top shelf of your local petrol station. It wasn't. It was supposed to be introducing new young talent into the music business and how to get a record deal and how to write a song. And the Grammy award-winning record producer Steve Levine turned up for a session that I was hosting about how to make your demo. And he just talked sense, and he was very eloquent, and he was great, and he invited me around to his studio. We became mates. And when I joined Radio 2... And he was still making records. And I was still trying to make radio programs. And then when The Late Show finished, I thought, well, what else can we do? I've only got Saturdays. I've got a week off. We can do things. And that's when the BBC was opening itself up to independent production. And Leslie Douglas said, almost like, what do you want to do? And I said, well, we've got these ideas. And one of them was a series called The Record Producers. And so Levine is brilliant at coming up with ideas and explaining how records are made. Because every now and again a record, I'm at the other end of the business from him. So I get the finished product and the vinyl or the CD would turn up, and occasionally I'd put one on and it would make me go, wow, how did they make that? And he said, oh, it's easy, you do this and this and this. And he can go into a studio and pull apart a multi-track tape, but he can articulate how those sounds are made. And he said, well, these guys, mostly guys, there are lots more women coming into the business now, but you take the Beatles. If it wasn't for George Martin, the Beatles might not have lasted as long as the Searchers, maybe. They had great songs. It was George Martin that made John Lennon and Paul McCartney's ideas work. And he was the record producer. So we wrote this up and Leslie said, yeah, do it. And we said, it's very expensive. And she said, it is, isn't it? Yeah, do it. So we did six, and they liked them, so we did more.
Typically, in the 1960s, orchestral musicians didn't wear headphones. They listened to the playback via speakers, and you can hear that spill very, very clearly just before the orchestra comes in.
Presumably, you couldn't hear that when they were playing because they were louder than the speaker.
Exactly. Right. And even though remixing was limited, it was still possible for the engineers to mute that track on the sections where...
And then we did other programmes... with Quincy Jones and Stephen Fry, and we just kept on doing programmes. And we thought, this is quite fun. And then we found other people that like buying stuff as well. So when he wasn't making a record and when I wasn't larking around in front of a microphone, it was never meant to be a production company. But it was just, if the things we haven't heard on the radio, what can we do? And we did. Then we called it Magnum Opus, which is supposed to be our best work. But it's amazing. You can have an idea, and in the research of that idea, it takes you in a completely different direction. So we ended up making programmes about the Third Reich inventing tape recording. It was called Third Reich and Roll, and it was presented by Stephen Fry. And we were doing a record producers on Roy Wood, and we asked for the multitracks. And he said, "Oh, I haven't got them." I said, "Who has got them?" "EMI, probably." So Steve's good at digging around. And we found them, and they were in a terrible state. He said, "If I put these on a multi-track machine, all the oxides are going to fall off." So we had to bake them for like 2 days. Because if you bake a tape, it softens the glue, and it brings the glue back to life and sticks the iron filings back on the tape. Which buffoon came up with the idea of gluing iron oxide onto a tape and passing it over a magnetic head? Who thought that? He said, "Oh, the Germans did." He said, "Yeah, they were recording on wire and lacquer, and that was rubbish." And so Hitler said, "Here's a load of money. I want a recording system that works." And so when the Allies went into Berlin at the end of the war, they found these magnetophones. "Take them back to America. We'll sort it out later." And so they did, and they gave them to a company in New York called Ampex, and they sort of made them work. But that was something that just came completely out of it, and it became an award-winning series.
CeeLo Green, it's okay. It's only Monday. Thank you for your mail. Thanks for being here. Thank you for your text this morning. In no particular order, it's Simon and Steve and Jeremy and Ken, and Chris Evans is next.
Alan Freeman said, "I can only do one thing, and it's sustained a broadcasting career of 40 years. You play classical music, you play rock music, you say greetings, music lovers.
Greetings, music lovers.
Not off. All right.
All right.
Stay bright.
Stay bright."
Five phrases have sustained a broadcasting career of about 40 years, and in so doing, you pulled off one of the biggest bank robberies in Britain. He said, "Yes, but you're versatile, and you can do that. They can put you anywhere, and you'll be fine." And I'm going, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I had a great time at Radio 2. And then they said, "Do you want to do Wogan for a bit?" And I looked at my diary, and I was actually working as much, looking back at that time, than I was when I had a, you know, regular 4 days a week. And it teaches you to interact with other people, and you do other things. I don't do impersonations of people. I try not to do impersonations of other people, but if you're doing a show at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then 2 weeks later you're doing one at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, The work is different, but the ethos is the same, I think. You've got to talk to a listener.
The Isley Brothers, his whole heart of mine, is a-thumping for you. We're all hot here on Radio 2, are we not, Allinson?
It depends how many scenes you've had.
Tell me no more. What did you get up to yesterday that people would be writing in, saying things that... Did you encourage them in their pet hates?
Would I? Yes. Yes.
Yes is the
got
answer.
Got it in one. Why?
And the more time you have to think about it. I remember that we did some phenomenal things on a Saturday afternoon. We had Boy George in Maid of Air. He hadn't done a live thing for ages. Robert Plant hadn't done a live thing for ages. We were in Newcastle. We got Dexys Midnight Runners on the same stage as Howard Jones. And Howard Jones was obvious 80s hits. Dexys were going back, and that was their first live gig for ages because Kevin had taken a few years off. And then it was the very, very first live gig on the radio from Amy Winehouse, and it was weird. I remember it vividly because it was about 6 o'clock at night, and Amy was the last live act, and they'd loved Howard Jones and they'd loved Dexys, and Amy was a bit of an unknown quantity, and she just came on with that powder blue Fender. She was 21, and I'm thinking, there's 300 Geordies in here, and they've all been drinking all afternoon. I hope they like this. We'd only heard the demo. I hadn't heard the live sound check or anything, so we introduce her, and she plays one chord and then sings just her and a guitar.
Your neighbors were screaming, "I don't have a
keyboard downstairs.
And she stopped. And there was about 3 seconds silence, and I thought, oh, I'm not going to say anything. And then the roof came off. They just tore the roof off. And she looked at me and smiled. I said, great. And so we had a drink in the bar afterwards. And then we came back on the same plane. And she was chatting away. I only met her once, that was it, the one time. But I have very fond memories of that because we meet lots of new artists in the mud in Glastonbury and lots of other places that Radio 2 goes. There was something about her that was just naive and ambitious. You couldn't contain it. She was talking about Donny Hathaway records that I hadn't heard. The sort of lifestyle of Ella Fitzgerald. And she knew so much about that, and she knew exactly what she wanted to do. And then it's all snuffed out 6 years later.
Meet you downstairs in a bar, your old sleeves.
BBC Radio Oxford was a pleasant diversion. Well, it wasn't a diversion. They invited me. BFBS, World Service, Capital, you know, Radio 2. They said, come. And they said, what are you doing on a Sunday morning? I said, nothing. I said, do you want to do a programme? So I had a really good producer called Louisa Hannon, who actually, I didn't know this at the time, but she's a really good presenter as well. So I'm being produced by a presenter. And I've never thought that's a good idea. But in this case, it seemed to be good. And I said, well, all I really know about Oxford is that it's on the M40, and I used to drive through it to get to London. And she said, right. So we had a big map. And she said, that's there, you pronounce it this way, and that's what happens there. And this bloke lives over there. Right, great. She would spend most of the week producing guests. And then you suddenly realise that Raymond Blanc lives in Oxford, and Robin Gibb lived in Oxford, and lots of people that you live in Oxford. So this is quite handy. You've had a lot of guests coming in on a Sunday morning. It took an hour to drive up there from London on the M40, spot a lunch, go home again. It got me into BBC local radio. I'd never done BBC local radio. It's nothing like Capital was. It's the BBC, but smaller. And I think at the time they had this new initiative. It's always worrying when a big organisation has an initiative. But the initiative was, I forget who they were called, but there was an archetypal 55-year-old married couple. Dave and Sue. That's it. This is, what, 12, 15 years ago? And you're still talking about this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant heterosexual married couple as being an archetypal BBC radio listener. And I'm thinking, okay, it's 15 years ago, but even so, aren't we sort of still in the past? You know, you're not listening, are you? Look, listen to your listeners. But of course then, it's the more you hang around radio, the more you hang around people who are frustrated and want to do something different. It can be incredibly fulfilling, but also every now and again you come up to the reality of somebody it should be like this and it's not like this. And I go, okay, why? I've never thought that it should be one way. I've always thought, do what you want to do and then see what happens. Throw it out there, see what comes back. And if what comes back isn't good, then it's you, it's not them.
Dark, isn't it? Yeah. I wasn't expecting that either. Hello, just to add to any confusion, I'm Richard Allinson on Drive Time on Magic. We're hanging around here till 8.
I'd been talking to Magic since the summer, this is 2014, about producing some content for the weekends, because they'd heard some of the stuff that we do at Magnum Opus. So they said, can you do some stuff for the weekend? Yeah, sure. And then Neil Fox gets arrested. And they said, right, are you available to do the Drive Time show? I was still contracted to Radio 2 at the time, but they said, yeah, go on. So we were advised by all the legal people that they couldn't be seen to be announcing any major changes to their programming because that might adversely affect the outcome of the case. So I slid under the wire pretty much and did 3 months of Drive Time and then another 3 months of Drive Time. And then they made me an offer, but I couldn't actually announce anything and they couldn't announce anything. It was sort of a stealth move, I think somebody described it as. But going from the BBC back to commercial radio, I remember when I joined Radio 2 in 97, Bob Harris and I were photographed in the back of the Times. And it said, the headline was Alison Harris, Radio 2 Youth Appeal. Now, I was 37. Bob was older. So again, somebody from the Times phones up and says, what's it like going back to commercial radio after 17 years at the BBC? Has the landscape changed at all? And I said, look, it is a different planet in a parallel universe, because it's not deregulation, but it's less regulation than there was in the late 90s. Studios are smaller, technology is much more refined, and budgets are severely reduced. And it's interesting working at Magic, because there's 18 radio stations coming out of one Golden Square. There's about 7 or 8 Absolutes. There's 4 Magics, a bunch of Kisses. There's Planet Rock, Kerrang. Jazz have moved in, and now, of course, Scala. They don't want to be too much overlap. So there are certain songs that work well on Absolute that don't work on Magic from the same artist and vice versa. And it took me quite a time to get my head around that, because I've never liked the way that they hang labels, even in record shops. You know, file under popular and stuff. They spend a lot of time working out how they should play the songs and in what order. And occasionally I go in and say, can we tweak that one, and can we do that, and can we do that? And they go, yeah, okay. Usually. And there's a couple of musical features that can change on a daily basis, so we tweak that. But the rest of it, from a production side, is pretty much set in stone, because it's been very tightly focused on. So if I'm playing 3 songs back to back with certain sweepers in between, you can go in and edit those segues. And I always do, because I'm an old disc jockey and that's how I work. You're always working at least one link ahead. As there are less links an hour and only a certain amount of time they would prefer you, you know, you've got to keep it going. Going back to those old Capital Radio rules of get on with it, cut the crap. If you've got nothing to say, say nothing. An old producer at Radio 2 used to say, pace, 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 keep it going. Because that what distinguishes my style of presentation from a lot of the other people who were on Radio 2 at the time. It's changed now, of course, but and that's only one producer's interpretation of it. But it's going back to the thing that I learnt a lot from Roger Scott. It's how to be more journalistic. Some of the best shows he did just seemed like an hour of perfect segues, and he'd just chase fades, jock a few intros. But it was what he said and how he said it, in very few words, and that delivery, and it was timeless, the way he could do that.
I'm sounding suspiciously like some burnt-out Woodstock relics here. Carole King, I Feel the Earth Move. Laura Nyro, whatever happened to her? Stone Soul Picnic. It's 2:58. Here comes the Sandman.
The challenge now, and it is a challenge every day, it's to try to use as few words as possible, but the right ones, and deliver them in the right way to set up the listener to enjoy the next song I'm going to play. Because I've always thought that that's my job. If I can say, look, if you like that, fine, but this you're going to enjoy just as much, even more perhaps. And it's setting it up. Alan Freeman always used to do it by the music jingles and the orchestral pieces he would use to set up the next song he was going to play on the chart show. He always convinced me there was nothing better I could do with my time than to listen to the next song he was about to play, because it was going to be better than this one. What? I can't wait to hear it. And the fanfare would stop and the music would start. And it's like, you know, the house lights go down, the curtains go up, stage lights come on at the start of every record. You can't do it at the start of every record, but that's proper music presentation, I think.
I can take a hint. They want me to shut up completely. Is that what they're saying? Magic,
we are hung up on radio and television and Spotify and YouTube and names for... It's audio and visual, isn't it? The music business is doing really well. The record business is sort of on its knees at the moment, but the music business is in rude health. A lot of the ownership and the money is not going the traditional route. But I think people listen to content or programs or stuff. And there are many, many more outlets. There are hundreds more radio stations than there were when I first started doing this. But I think people have a handful of favorites. I'm not sure the human brain has got more capacity for more than a handful of favorites. So you'll go to your favorite presenters, you'll go to your favorite radio stations, your favorite websites. You'll follow your favourite people on Twitter. I don't think that'll change. I just think the delivery system will be more refined. I've got three sons. They're 26, 22 and 20. They don't have a radio, but they're aware of new music and they're aware of people on the radio. There is a radio in our kitchen. There's a radio in my bedside and that's it. The rest of it comes out of computers and phones and all the other things that you tap into in the car. They still like music. They've got record collections. They've got sound systems. They do all that stuff. But radio is part of an ever-increasing entertainment spectrum, I think. When we were growing up, it was radio and telly and a gramophone. And then the cassette came out, and so music became portable. Everything is portable. If the rights people sort it out and you can get everything everywhere, it won't necessarily be about the person who shouts loudest. They will still find what they want, and they will still list that as their favourites. The curation process, I think, is the big hurdle, because I think there is just so much to choose from.
Drive Home on Magic. If you're new to Magic, that's two of us, me too, and Trudy Giddy and Simon Kenyon and Nick, who's doing his tax return to celebrate.
Oh, great. It's interesting. My dad was in construction all his life, and a lot of the projects he was proudest of were in and around Birmingham, and we could drive around Birmingham, and he said, my foundations are in there. My steel is in Spaghetti Junction, part of it. The steel reinforcement in the concrete. And that hospital window frames, they're mine. And that school's roof lights, they're mine. And he was proud of jobs that he'd done and buildings that he'd helped put up. The ones that he liked the look of, the ones he got on with the architects well. In broadcasting, you don't have that. You don't have that tangible legacy because you work a lot. And I'm sorry, I do work a lot on the presentation of my magic show. A lot of people say, it's commercial radio, it's all done for you. No, it's not. You can hear the people who think it's all done for them. I'm sorry to say. For me, I've got to go in and kick it about a bit and lean on it. And it's only three links, but those are your three chances of getting it right. And it's bloody easy to get it wrong. We don't have that tangible legacy of that piece of work was published in the paper or this book is published. We're radio and telly, and it's gone. And so I'm always thinking of what's going to happen tomorrow. The most challenging period has been when something has gone wrong in my personal life. I've always thought that you leave your baggage in the door when you go into a studio. The first time I went into a radio studio and the door closed and the speakers were off, and I'd never been in a soundproof room before, and they do sound different. And I think, this is a radio studio. And you turn everything up and then it becomes a different place, that special place. I do think on the radio is a special place and a radio studio should be. And we lost a little girl when she was 16. Our youngest son nearly died when he was 11 weeks old. My wife died last summer. And those are the three occasions when I've thought, I can give this all up tomorrow because it's not important, especially when Bruce was 11 weeks and I'd taken a week off work because Linda was living with him in the hospital, so I'd looked after the other two. I'd gone back to work and it was a Monday night and I was introducing a Beverly Craven concert in the radio theatre at the BBC, and then I was going to go upstairs to do the Radio 2 show, and I just had a bad feeling all evening. And so I went up to the studio and there was something in the back of my mind and I couldn't switch it off, and I got into the studio and I still couldn't switch it off. And so I opened the programme. In the second song, the bat phone went and it was the broadcast duty manager, and he came in and he said, I've had a conversation with your brother-in-law, call the hospital. So I called the hospital and the nurse said, well, Bruce's lungs had collapsed. He'd been in there for a week. They'd said he was fine, he's getting better, go back to work, and I didn't feel right. So the resus team had to bring him back. And then he spent 2 weeks in Great Ormond Street intensive care. Radio 2 were great, actually, because they said take as much time off as you want, but I was in no state to introduce records and talk to other people or anything. And I just thought, I've had a great career then, and this is 20 years ago. Take it all. I just want this little 11-week-old bundle. And he's fine now. Doesn't remember a thing about it. he was the fastest runner in school. You know, it's stupid. But those things come in. It wasn't anything to do with individuals in broadcasting. It's only records on the radio. And we think that is important, and you should take it incredibly seriously. But I don't think individuals should take themselves seriously at all. And it's those things. Linda taught me how to love people and to stop looking at your record collection and go out and smell the flowers. This is going to sound a bit strange, but there's a very positive force that talking to somebody you've never met before and playing them songs that they like. I've seen it. I've heard when programs have ended and you've gone somewhere else, and when I left Capital and then when I left Radio 2, the people are saying, "Well, we can't follow you because you're on a different time of the day." But there have been times in your life when we've been locked in our padded cell talking to ourselves, and it's resonated with somebody out there going through good times or bad times, and they remember it and then they send it back to you. And I remember one the last Late Show I did on Radio 2, the emails were coming in for, we couldn't read them. They would go on preview, they were coming in too quickly. So the producer just said, "Look, here's a quick snapshot." And then he printed off a load of them afterwards, and we were reading them afterwards. And there were people had been through really tragic and tumultuous times in their lives. And he said, "You played a song by Don Henley, and it was New York Minute, and we sat there crying, and it's a moment we'll never forget." And in my air-conditioned padded room, just playing a song because I love it, you just think, wow, that is incredibly powerful. And if I don't really think, if I'd have known that radio was that powerful when I wanted to play records to myself when I was a disc jockey, I'd never have gone anywhere near it. Because it has the power to touch people in the way that other mediums can't, I think. Because it's that unknown quantity. We don't know this guy, but this voice and this music at this time means something. And I've always tried to understand how what we do in our air-conditioned padded room is received by any old cliche. You know, the housewife, white van man, the guy on the building site, the people at school, the nurse, whatever. I think it was Noel Edmonds who said, "Do it for yourself." There are lots of people that say, put a picture of your partner in front of the microphone, talk to them. That gets a bit self-indulgent, doesn't it? No, you have to do it for yourself. And you can't be the judge. The audience has to be the judge. You can't say whether you're good enough. Someone else has to judge it for you.